Let's humble our hearts before Almighty Yahweh. Father, we come before you on this Sabbath day. We're so grateful to be able to come and worship with brethren of like faith. We know that one day this might not be possible as we see the trends of closing doors in this country as the evil one starts taking over. And we pray, Almighty Yahweh, that we'll be allowed to continue worshiping you as our heart's desire, for we know that only through you do we find the everlasting life that you have promised. We thank you for this day. We pray that the words you will be spoken will be a comfort to us and that it might help us to better understand you as we strive to learn your word. We pray that many others who are listening would also be edified, and we ask that you touch them as well. Be with us now as we study and learn of you, as we strive to walk that narrow way. This prayer and petition now we ask in Yahshua's name. Hallelujah. And you may be seated. Well, it's great to be back. We had a great visit back to Pennsylvania and saw the relatives, and the grandchildren got to dip their toes in the ocean for the first time. And yeah, that was a joy to be there to watch that. Also, we were able to meet with a new couple into the wee hours of the Sabbath out in their gazebo, surrounded with screen. It was just a wonderfully inspiring time, and cool air was blowing through as we studied Yahweh's word. And then the next Sabbath, that morning, we met with some brethren we haven't seen for 30 years, and that was also a very inspiring service we had, and we're glad to have made the trip and the contact with the people. But Dorothy was right. It's good to be home. There's no place like home, and we're glad to be back among the brethren as well. I want to welcome all those who are visiting today and glad that you could be with us. Pray that this day will be a blessing to you. Growing up, the doctrine that was drilled into us was basically, we don't have to do anything but have faith alone. You can probably guess what denomination that was. But if we look at the faith chapter, Hebrews chapter 11, we find that faith is defined as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The NIV says, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. The New Century Version says, faith being sure of the things we hope for and knowing that something is real even if we do not see it. Well, basically, faith means having conviction and having a complete belief and trust in Yahweh. And from that conviction, we go to action. And that's what I want to talk about today. Most people want to keep their faith kind of nebulous and very private. Faith for them is only a vague, wishy-washy belief that is professed when convenient. This means that the majority of people today are what you could call theoretical atheists. Practical atheists. And what I mean by that is they might have a theoretical belief in Yahweh, but that has nothing to do with their daily lives. We all know these kinds. They, you know, have a nominal belief that they profess, but they refuse to really obey. It doesn't go anywhere. It stops. And that is because they have a low opinion of their Heavenly Father. That's the only reason. If they really believed and really had faith and really had respect for Him, they would do what they're commanded to do. But they have a low opinion of Him. He's only there for certain occasions, like just in case they might get sick or maybe a close relative passes away. Then they need Him. Otherwise, He has no purpose in their life. Other than they can say, well, I believe in Him and I have an affiliation, and that's as far as it goes. They have no use for his Sabbath, his feasts, his commandments. They just don't care. One of the most important aspects to true faith is total unwavering conviction and confidence. 100% believing that something that Yahweh says will happen, will happen. You know, not even the biggest patriarchs in the Bible had total and complete faith. They were all human like we are, yet they had to learn what faith was all about. Abraham, of course, is known as a man of faith. And when Yahweh called him to leave his country to go to a land he would show him, what did he do? Did he just say, well, I have faith, faith alone. I don't really have to go there. No, he obeyed. Yahweh eventually made a covenant with him and promised that he would be the father of many nations and have many descendants. But there was a problem. He and wife Sarah were childless. At 86, he had a lapse of faith. And because of that, he became the father of one known as Ishmael, born to his servant, an Egyptian, Hagar. And this wasn't according to Yahweh's will. And we're still living with the consequences. And we're going to have more consequences in the future because of this mistake. At age 99, Yahweh appeared to him and confirmed his covenant, stating that his wife Sarah, age 90, would bear a son through whom the promises would be passed. Ishmael wasn't the one. 1 year later, as promised, they had a son named Isaac. But Abraham recovered from his lack of faith. Later, Ishmael and his mother were sent away. Then we read in Genesis chapter 22 that Yahweh was going to test Abraham to see what kind of faith he had, to see if he really had what it took. So in Genesis 22, I want to start with verse 1. We're going to find out what kind of faith this man really had, and was it just talk and no action? And it came to pass after these things that Elohim did tempt or test Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, behold, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, you know, the one you've been waiting for all these years, the one that was miraculously given to you, even though you're 100 years old, take him up to Mount Moriah, into the land of Moriah, and offer him. Moriah is a Hebrew word, and it means to show or be provided by Yah, Moriah. So he did, and offer him there in the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell you of. Abraham rose up early in the morning. Didn't quibble, did he? Rose up early in the morning. He saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and the wood that was split for the burnt offering, and rose up and went up into the place of which Yahweh had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, abide here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again unto you. Interesting, isn't it? He said, I'm going to come again unto you. Yeah, he was going to be tested, but he had faith that he's coming back. He knew. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son and took the fire. Isn't that interesting too? Isaac had to carry the wood just as Joshua did. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, apparently off the altar he took the fire. And they went, both of them together. And Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I, son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, my son, Yahweh will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them together. Faith again. And they came to the place where Elohim had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him upon the altar on the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. What a test. The most precious thing in his life. And Yahweh says, give him to me. So he was ready. Ready to go. And at that point, Yahweh knew this man had the faith that it took. Not only just the conviction, but the action that it took. And the angel, verse 11 of Yahweh, called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, lay not your hand upon the lad, neither do you anything unto him. For now I know that you fear Elohim, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And of course he looked up, saw a ram in the thicket, and sacrificed that instead. Another key individual, an apostle we read in the New Testament. Peter was out there in the boat and Yahshua was walking on the water. He says, can I come out there? And Yahshua said, go ahead. Here he goes. Here he goes. But he lacked total faith, didn't he? Because once out there, he started to doubt. And then he started to sink. Had he had the real faith, he wouldn't have hesitated at all, been fazed at all with a single doubt. Yahweh puts our faith to the test, brethren. You go through something in your life and think, oh, what is wrong? What's happening? Why is this happening to me? Could easily just as well be a test. How are you going to react? How will you do in light of the extreme pressure maybe that's put on you? He tests our faith. This is the aspect of faith that most clerics like to ignore. 1 John 5:4 says, faith is victorious when what? It overcomes the world. See, there's something that must be done with that conviction, with that faith. And this is consistent with Yahshua's teachings. Over in Revelation 14:12, tells us that the saints are those that keep the commandments as well as, along with their faith. Two things go together. You see, it's not just faith alone. It's obedience as well. When we think of faith, I guess most of us think of the lowly old mustard seed, don't we? Yahshua's parable. In Luke 17, verse 5, the apostles were sitting around with Yahshua one day and said, man, we need more faith. Yahshua, give us more faith. 17, verse 5. So here's what he said. Verse 6, if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you might say unto this sycamore or sycamine tree, be you plucked up by the root, and be you planted in the sea, and it should obey you. Wow. 20th century New Testament says, give us more faith. And the apostles said, the apostles to the master, but the master said, if your faith were only like a mustard seed. There's a distinction there in the words. I'd like you to notice that. You could say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey. Well, a man once decided to put this to the test. He went out to his yard, went to the big tree out in his yard, got up to it, and said, when I get up in the morning, I want you to be gone. He woke up the next morning, went to the front door, looked out and said, just as I thought, it's still there. Clearly, he had no faith at all, did he? He never expected the tree to move. A person with complete faith wouldn't question whether it would happen or not. He'd know it would happen. Mustard seed. Interesting metaphor Yahshua uses. He also used it in Matthew 13, verse 31, where he had another parable. He said, the kingdom of heaven is like to a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all seeds. When it is grown, it's the greatest among herbs, and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and lodge in the branches thereof. Ever seen a mustard seed? It's like the period in the end of a sentence in your newspaper, about that size. When Yasha mentioned the mustard seed, he was referring to a small black seed. Our seeds here are basically yellow. This is what we use in this country, grown mostly up north, North Dakota, Canada, Montana. We use the yellow mustard. Here it was, most scholars say it's the black mustard over in Israel. Can you imagine something that size becoming a tree, virtually a tree? Or a bush, at any rate. Imagine that such a seed like faith could move Mount Everest or uproot a tree and throw it into the sea. I've always been bothered by this analogy. I've never quite understood it. If it takes only that little amount of faith, what have I got? I've got nothing. I don't get it. If just, you know, the size of a pinhead, what hope do I have? When I read this, and you know, any hope that I had just vanished like a drop of water on hot pavement. It just disintegrated, disappeared. There had to be something more to this analogy. More than just small seeds representing small but powerful amounts of faith. You know, Yasha could have used any seed if he'd wanted to. He could have, like we're familiar here, with something like an acorn, where the seed's bigger, but look what it produces, a tree that's humongous, huge tree. It grows into a massive thing, much larger than a mustard plant. Why did he use mustard seed? That's the issue. Why did he use that kind of analogy? We have to understand a little bit about the characteristics of mustard. Did a little study and found out that mustard is a disease-resistant and very hardy plant. It comes in four different colors, yellow, white, brown, and black. To survive into a veritable bush from such a small start, it has to be two things, very persistent and very hardy. Farmers say that mustard starts out slowly and then it grows rather aggressively once it gets going, takes over a field. And it doesn't quit until it reaches maturity in the Mideast, a little higher than it does here. Well, this reminded me of another parable, one of an unjust judge. Maybe you remember that one over in Luke chapter 18. This lady needed a judgment. And in Luke 18, let's just read the first few verses. He spake a parable unto them, to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. In other words, have faith. Saying, there was in a city a judge which feared not Elohim, neither regarded man. He was a snobby old guy. He didn't care. He was the judge. And nobody was going to be over him. And there was a widow in that city. And she came unto him saying, avenge me of mine adversary. In other words, whatever it could be. You know, she's got a problem with somebody and she needs help. And she needs maybe some kind of retainer put on him or something. I don't know. To keep her safe. Anyway, avenge me of my adversary. Verse 4, he would not for a while. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. I don't care. But afterward, he said within himself, though I fear not Elohim nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. She didn't give up. Kept coming to him. Please, help me, help me, help me, help me. He got tired of it day in, day out, day in, day out. Oh, man. All right. And the master said, hear what the unjust judge says. And shall not Elohim avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, notice this. When the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth? Interesting connection. He's talking about persistence, and then he says, when Yahshua comes, will there be faith on the earth? You know, the word weary me in this verse is really a word in the Greek describing what they call a pugilist, someone who goes out and fights for a living. boxers, you know, get out there, prize fighter, constantly pounding someone in the eye until he gives up, falls over unconscious or whatever. That's how he wins. He keeps at it over and over and over, never letting up, by keeping on the blows, and the opponent finally goes down and he wins. He won't let up. He's very tenacious. A successful general will enter a fight to win. He won't give up. He won't let up. He won't let the enemy up. He keeps him down and keeps pounding. And that's how you win. And that's what this lady here is also doing. She's not giving up. She knows what she needs, and she's going to keep at it until she gets it. And that's what Yahshua was talking about. Is he going to find that kind of faith on the earth when Yahshua comes back? People that won't give up, they'll go at it and continue on and on and on. Another example of such tenacity is found in Genesis chapter 22. Jacob. Amazing man. You know, he's later got his name changed, of course, to Israel. But he's an amazing man. Even from birth, he was an amazing man. No matter how he schemed to get his way, and basically he had one main purpose, he was always blessed of Yahweh. Why would Yahweh bless such a man? Genesis 25, verse 22. And the children, this is speaking of Rebekah when she was with two children, and the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of Yahweh. What's this going on in my tummy here? Why have I got all this turmoil? And Yahweh said unto her, "Two nations are in your womb." Whoa. Two nations are in your womb. Can you imagine? What is she thinking now? "And two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out, red all over, like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she bare him, 80 years. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents." We had two different kinds of individuals here, basically. We had a outdoorsman, and we had a scholar, you might say. He dwelled in tents. He stayed home, read books. He was interested in different things. "And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison." Apparently Isaac was kind of an outdoorsy type too. And, like a father wants his son to follow in his footsteps, oftentimes he was glad to have somebody who had the same interests. But Rebekah loved Jacob. She had a different interest, and this son was more like her, I guess. Well, we know that from this family, we have a struggle going on even today with the father of the Arabs and the father of Israel. Anyway, even coming out of the womb, Jacob tries to grab his brother's heel, trying to grab his rights, his privileges as an elder brother. He got out first, but he wishes he could have gone out first, because he had been the firstborn then if that had happened. He was eyeing the prize, you might say. And when Esau came in famished one day, Jacob told his brother he would give him something to eat if he would sell him his birthright. Esau didn't care. He could care less about his birthright at that time. Later, when his father Isaac was about to give the blessing to Esau as the elder brother, Jacob listened to his mother's suggestion. We remember the story where he dressed up like his brother and disguised himself, and Isaac couldn't see well anyway, so he thought he was giving the blessing to Esau. Jacob comes away with a blessing. Esau was enraged, but despite all the deception, it was a plan of Yahweh from the beginning. Esau decides he's going to kill his brother. His mother says, "Get out of here, Jacob. Go. Go to your uncle in Haran." Paul in Romans 9 quotes the Old Testament saying Esau is a profane person and that Yahweh hated him. He wasn't interested in the promise. He was living for himself. He was living for this world, in this world, totally immersed in what this world has to offer. That's Esau right there, in a nutshell. At least at that point. Later on, he's going to wish he had done things a little differently, but then it was too late. So anyway, the blessings continued because Jacob was always wanting more from Yahweh. He had that kind of faith and conviction. He's always after more. I want the blessing. I want to be your son, your spiritual son. He prayed about it. And Yahweh spoke promises to this troublesome young man. A dream and a ladder to heaven spoke words of a covenant promise that Yahweh would bless him with and return him again to his own land, which gave him hope. Even through the years of servitude in exchange for Laban's daughters and flocks, he had hope and he still had an overriding desire of faith. So this is where it led to. Yahweh finally gave him knowledge of how to increase even the flocks that he wanted, and he got very rich by doing it. I was questioned about this recently. This is fascinating. I don't know if you ever thought about Genesis chapter 30. A strange little incident here, one of the strangest in the Bible. Genesis 30, verse 31. Laban said he can go ahead. He told Laban he'd go ahead and he would keep all the speckled and the striped of the flock. Laban can have the rest. Laban said, "That's fine." And so in verse 31, he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything if you will do this thing for me. I will again feed and keep your flock. I'll pass through all your flock today, removing from thence all the speckled and spotted cattle and all the brown cattle among the sheep and the spotted and speckled among the goats. And of such shall be my hire." That's my payment. I'll take the less than wanted ones. "So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come. When it shall come for my hire before your face, every one that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the sheep shall be counted stolen with me." In other words, if I end up with those pure colored ones, then you can just might as well say I stole it, because you won't have those in my flock. Laban said, "Okay, I'll do it." And he removed that day the he-goats. Now he's playing a little game with him, which he always did, Laban did. He removed that day the he-goats that were ring-straked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, and every one that had some white in it, and all the brown among the sheep, and gave them into the hand of his sons. And he set 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. So he tried to short-circuit the plan, and he took all the striped ones for give it to his sons. Real nice guy, isn't he? Well, Jacob's 3 days away. He doesn't know what's going on. Anyway, he set 3 days' journey. And Jacob took this. Okay, here it starts. Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of the hazel and chestnut tree and peeled white strakes in them. In other words, peeled off the bark and left them striped, basically what it's saying. And made the white appear, which was in the rods. And he set the rods, which he had pilled before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle, ring-straked, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob did separate the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the ring-straked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. And he put his own flocks by themselves and put them not in Laban's cattle, like he said he was going to do. And he did. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger cattle did conceive, that Jacob laid the rods before their eyes of the cattle in the gutters, and they might conceive among the rods. And when the cattle were feeble, he put them not in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger were Jacob's. These two guys are something else. And the man increased exceedingly, and had much cattle, and maidservants, and menservants, and so forth. Rich became very rich through his is conniving, I guess. I was asked, this person was told that Jacob was dabbling in magic because he took the stripe, you know, made stripes out of the sticks and stuck there in the watering trough. And when they came to drink, they would ostensibly give striped cattle, striped spotted animals from that. Well, you know, there's a great deal that science doesn't understand even today about heredity and how you transmit it. It may be that he knew something about these animals that even modern biologists have yet to learn. They've learned a few things, and it's remarkably some of these things are true. There are certain factors that can influence a pregnant animal in that stage and can determine to some degree the physical characteristics of the offspring. Certain chemicals can have a significant hereditary influence if they can reach the embryo, the DNA, and the germ cells. And it's possible that certain chemicals in wood of these trees, you know, that were peeled rods, were actually in the water when they came to drink. They were capable of affecting the animals. If nothing else, the water perhaps served as an aphrodisiac and fertility promoter among the cattle and other animals. At least maybe some chemical substance found in these trees has been used for such a purpose both anciently and in modern times. And whether or not the sense of sight can actually make a difference, you know, would certainly be poo-pooed today. But there is no doubt that there was a strong effect somehow in the physiological mechanisms going on here. Maybe Yahweh. I mean, if nothing else, Yahweh made something happen supernaturally. Well, anyway, we know that the body does respond to certain things that's seen. People see blood getting nauseated. You know, some people, they can't stand that. You see a gruesome sight, and you just revulsed, you know. The mere sight of the striped rods may have served as an aphrodisiac. And it's interesting that in verse 38, the word translated conceive in the King James is actually the Hebrew yakam, meaning to be in heat. So the verse may be read, and he set the rods which he peeled before the flocks in the gutters in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should become in heat or hot when they came to drink. In some way, probably we don't understand, but some animal raisers have confirmed it. The sight of these streaked rods did something to these animals. When Jacob finally left Haran and Laban, he knew that his brother Esau was still alive and would certainly be his enemy. So he offered peace offerings to his brother and went out alone to pray and seek Yahweh, still with the faith, that driving faith that he had. Then in Genesis 32, we read of something else very odd, difficult for us to contemplate or understand. 32, we've all remember this account, verse 24, where his name gets changed. Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Wrestled there. It's a play on words. The Hebrew is Jabbok, which is a awful lot like Jacob, isn't it, with a couple of letters transposed. And when he saw that he had prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. Why? The hollow of his thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. Notice verse 26, he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." That's the angel, angelic being. And he said, "I will not let you go except you bless me." I've often wondered, what in the world would he be walking out through the countryside all of a sudden see a man start wrestling with him? Does that make any sense to you? Doesn't to me either. But notice, We're talking about heel grabber. We're talking about the man who likes to strive for a purpose. He went and this angel was there, and I believe that he's asking for a blessing. Again, like he always did. He wanted a blessing. And the angel wanted to go, and he wouldn't let him go. And so they quote, wrestled. One tried to pull loose, the other one kept pulling down, and finally the angel, it says, touched his thigh. Other translations indicate that he actually, it was more than his thigh. It was his, what would you call it? He couldn't have kids after that. And because he already had Benjamin, he didn't need any more kids. The blessing was there for his 12 sons. And so this is what happened. He's still preoccupied. He still wants the blessing. He recognizes this being as an emissary from Yahweh, and he says, I want the blessing. So he says, he struggled with him. Finally, he had to touch him, wound him, so that he would let him go. He said, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince have you power with Yahweh and with men, and has prevailed. His faith, finally, through struggle and trial, overcame. Just as the woman had persisted with the unjust judge day after day after day, Jacob had been persistent, obsessed with his goal to be blessed of Yahweh. This is what I believe mustard faith is all about. I will not let you go till you bless me. I will not let go until you avenge mine adversary. Persistence. Small but mighty. Matthew chapter 9. Still further examples prove that faith has to be a tenacious persistence. It's not just some kind of nebulous belief. Just kind of, that's all I need. Just to know that he's my Savior. That's all I need. No, there's more to it than that. And you look at the people, the Hall of Fame of the Faithful in Hebrews 11, each one of them is persistent. And they don't quit. They go on and on and on until the prize is had. Matthew 9, verse 20. And behold, a woman, which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years, came behind Yahshua and touched the hem of his garment. And she said within herself, If I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. Now Yahshua had a lot of people around him at that point, no doubt. They're pressing in to touch him, to be healed. How could she manage that? Maybe she crawled around on the ground through all the people's legs, finally got to him. Touched the fringe of his garment. Virtue went out of Yahshua. He could feel it. He said, who touched me? And his disciples reminded him that everyone around him was trying to do that. But Yahshua looked down and saw the mustard seed faith of this woman. And that's all it took. That's all it took. She was made whole. He said, daughter, be good and be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole. And she was made whole from that hour. Matthew 15, another example. When the woman came to Yahshua by night as he sat eating and asked for healing for her daughter, Yahshua tested her. See, sometimes we don't get the answer right away. Sometimes we have to be tested. Yahweh wants to know what's really in our hearts. Are you just going to get the healing and then go off and be as you were before? Or are you really willing to follow and obey me? He says, we read here in verse 27, Matthew 15. She said, let's go back and read that. She wants to be healed. Let's see, where do I want to start? She came, verse 25, and worshipped him, saying, Master, help me. And he said, it is not meet or fitting to take the children's bread and to cast it to the dogs. She gave a very interesting response. In other words, you're not one of mine. And basically, she said, truth, master, yet the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Yahshua answered and said unto her, O woman, great is your faith. Why? She didn't just walk away. She was persistent. Be it unto you, even as you will. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. Here we see mustard seed faith in action. And Yahshua healed her daughter. Over in Mark chapter 10. We find another example. Mark chapter 10. You look at these people who really had faith. They knew Yahshua could help them. They had faith that he would. And they were persistent. And they came to Jericho, verse 46. And as he went out to Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, some blind guy named Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. And when he heard that it was Yahshua who was passing by, he began to cry out and saying, Yahshua, son of David, have mercy on me. And many charged him that he should hold his peace. Shut up. The old man, blind man, beggar, shut up. But he wasn't going to stop there. He cried the more. You, son of David, have mercy on me. Yahshua stood still and commanded him to be called. And they called the blind man, saying unto him, be of good comfort, rise, he calls you. And he casting away his garment, rose and came to Yahshua. And Yahshua answered and said unto him, what will I do for you, basically? The blind man said to him, Master, that I might receive my sight. Yahshua said unto him, go your way, your faith has made you whole. Immediately his sight was received, and he followed Yahshua. Notice the last part. He followed Yahshua. Most of the people Yahshua dealt with followed him around because they wanted some fish. They wanted some bread. That's all they wanted. And they were gone. How many stood with Yahshua at the very end? Big fat zero. Nobody was with him. Not even his disciples. He died alone. This man here followed Yahshua after he was healed. And that's what Yahshua wanted. That's what faith is all about. You don't just forget. But we human beings have short memories. We forget the bad really quick and we go on our merry way. You look at these examples of faith, and you see a common characteristic through all of them. Intense, no holds barred. Think of wrestler Jacob. Passion for Yahweh. That's what Yahweh's looking for. This kind of faith. It's when we let that intense hunger, that intense resolve, go into action that we can move mountains and cast out trees into the sea. When we hunger and thirst so much that we'll do anything to satisfy it, we will walk the mustard seed faith. You know, Yahshua wants us to bother him, to get his attention. He wants that. He wants us to focus on him for once, tug on the hem of his garment. Call out to the Father and keep going at it until we get the answers, until we get healed, until we obtain our blessing. This was the persistence that we see in the Scriptures, and it means we really and truly will do whatever we need to do to get it done. And that, brethren, is real faith. Just wishing it doesn't do it. We're to come boldly to the throne of grace, we read. Luke 11:9 says, and say, I unto you, ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, we could put with all your heart, and you shall find. Knock, and we could add, and keep on knocking, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asks receives, and he that seeks finds, and to him that knocks it shall be opened. Another characteristic, and this is kind of interesting, about mustard seeds. I understand that if you plant, for instance, tomatoes close to jalapenos, you'll get some hot tamales. You'll get some hot tomatoes. Many other plants and vegetables can't grow next to other ones because they take on the characteristics and that destroys the flavor, the nutrition, whatever, if they're too close. And because they do that, Yahweh says don't mix seed. Remember, he said don't. There was a trend 20, 30 years ago where, you know, it was natural gardening, just throw all the seeds together in a plot. Yahweh says don't do that. For one thing, you're going to play with genetics that way, and they're going to be, you know, fertilizing themselves and the others as well, and just create a real problem. So you don't mix the seeds. Israelites understood that. He understood that order reflects holiness, and disorder indicates falsity and error. You mix seed in the same plot, and you lead to confusion and to something you don't want, something that's going to alter something. Certain plants cannot grow, they say, near a black walnut tree or even near its roots because they take in the toxins that these things give off. We used to have some black walnuts, and you crack those walnuts that are just falling on the ground. They're harder than the dickens, but you drive over them and crack them, crack the outside shell, and it's very pungent, very strong, especially when they're, you know, pretty fresh. But a mustard seed, a mustard bush, can be grown around anything. It's not affected by its surroundings. You could plant a mustard seed right on top of a jalapeno, and it'll grow and be nothing like the jalapeno, completely unaffected. So should our faith. So should our faith. Be like a mustard seed, unwavering, unaffected by our surroundings, the people, the world around us. We just stay on course all the way through. The patriarchs were unique with this characteristic. A faith so strong it was unwavering. And they would stop at nothing, not even their own lives. Nothing could stop them. Faith is called the substance of things hoped for in the first verse of Hebrews 11. The evidence of things not seen. Substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Just as our physical eyesight senses the material world around us, faith is a sense that gives us evidence of what we can't see, the spiritual world, of things hoped for. These people had enormous insight into the spiritual to be what they were and to do what they did. They had to have been these patriarchs of the Bible that held this faith. If you have some substance before you, you can see it and tell what it is. Faith is needed for something we can't see, we can't touch. Faith does not contradict reason, but it might go well beyond reason. I could maybe objectively prove the Bible to my satisfaction that it's the most unusual book ever produced and has impacted society more than any other book, but only faith can prove that the Bible is Yahweh's word. And so it's this belief beyond reason, but doesn't contradict reason. That's what faith really is. By faith, we're told, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word. How were they framed by the word? It happened when Yahweh commanded, "Let there be light." We read in the Psalms that by the word of Yahweh, the heavens were made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. He spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood fast. Psalm 33. We can look and by reason alone say, no way. No way could this world have come on into existence by itself. But true faith tells us it was Yahweh who did it. He tells us he did it. Do we believe it? Hebrews chapter 11, verse 2. By faith, the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of Elohim, so that the things which we see were not made of things which do appear. Back in the time of Israel, they thought that the world came about through things that were already there. Hebrews tells us that they came out of nothing. By faith, Abel offered unto Elohim a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, Elohim testifying of his gifts, and by it, he being dead yet speaks. Abel. And it wasn't just because his was animal and the other was vegetable. This difference also was the fact that Abel had faith, because he cared enough to get it right. By faith, it says, Enoch was translated that he should not see death and was not found because Elohim had translated him, moved him. For before his translation, he had this testimony. What? What was his testimony? That he pleased Yahweh. How do we please Yahweh? By being obedient to him. That's how we please Yahweh. That's what his faith translated into, a desire to please Yahweh. And then verse 6 it says, but without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that comes to Elohim must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Mustard faith. You have to diligently seek him. Not something you do for an hour a week. It's something you do every day of your life. By faith, Noah, being warned of Elohim of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world. He didn't go out and say, you stupid world. Basically, through his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. Righteousness by faith. You do something. James talks about that. Faith without works is dead. We can go on through this whole chapter, each of these people. Noah, be warned of Elohim, he acted. Didn't sit back and say, uh-oh, well, we're finished now. He went ahead and did something. He created, built an ark. He moved. Real faith will always do something. The book of James, as I said, mentions that. Abraham's obedience by faith, it says. He dwelt in a land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents, and Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him. Same promise. He waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is Elohim. He lived as a sojourner in the land. He never felt comfortable where he lived. Neither should we. Never owned much at first, except the plots that he and Sarah were buried in. Dwelt is the ancient Greek word perikois, and it means a resident alien, one who lives somewhere but doesn't have permanent status there. Sarah herself also received strength to conceive. She bore a child. By faith, Sarah's faith. It wasn't perfect. She first laughed. Remember? She laughed in unbelief. How can I have a child at this age? No way. And then she learned that it can happen, and then had faith. We can go on, each of these people. Each of them died in faith, it says, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. Faith of Abraham and Sarah started it all, basically. They died in faith. For those who say such things, it says, declare plainly that they seek a homeland. Confess that they were strangers and pilgrims. They saw the promises afar off, willing to look at it and consider the promise of Yahweh, even though it seems so far away. Sometimes we look out and we see, oh man, everything is just so without it. You know, out of my reach, I can't really fathom it all. Faith will help you get through that. Romans 16, 23. And this is Paul signing off. That's not what I wanted. Verse 25. Now to him that is of power to establish you according to my evangel and the preaching of Yahshua the Messiah, according to the revelation of the mystery which was kept secret since the world began, but now is made manifest, and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the everlasting Elohim, made known to all nations. How? Obedience of faith. Two concepts put together, obedience and faith. And that's where it's all at, brethren. That's where the focus is. That's where the nexus is. You have obedience because you have faith. You have faith, therefore you obey. That's what all these people did. They did whatever Yahweh told them to do. It wasn't always easy. Sometimes they had real problems doing it, but they did it because they sought a homeland, a better something than what they have here on this earth. Walking is faith. Is a lot easier. Walking in faith is a lot easier when we realize that this isn't our home. You know, we're looking for something better. As long as you keep your eye out there, things here don't have much impact, do they? Not everything is settled. Not every wrong is righted, but that's why we seek something greater, something more in this life than what we see here. I hope that we can each have a little more of that faith, maybe a lot more of that faith, that we find in the scriptures, these people that lived by it and not just talked it, but actually sought with all their heart to be close to Yahweh, to have the faith it takes to be one of His. May Yahweh bless you.